And am I wired for the whole thing, so I just need to...
Just project. Yeah,
okay.
We don't have a microphone.
That's fine. I'm fine. I like to do that anyway.
Okay. Okay. We're ready?
All right. Thank you. It's been my dream for a long time to come to Bhutan, and my dreams come true. I'm going to move fairly quickly because I have a lot of slides. But you can see the title, and let's just move on. I am the co-founder and co-owner of a company called Herb Farm, which we're celebrating our 30th anniversary also. We started Herb Farm in my kitchen, literally, my kitchen and my garage. Fast forward 30 years later, and we have 85 employees and sell, out of the top 100 selling single herbs in the United States, we have 40 of them. These are just some of the products that we have. We work with approximately 160 some different herbs, which we use to make about 250 different products. About half of those herbs are certified organically grown, most of them on my farm, which you'll see some photos of later. About half of them are wild harvested, or what we call custom wildcrafted. I'm going to move on initially to talk about wild harvesting of herbs and some of the things that we consider that we do. And here's an herb that you may or may not be familiar with. It's actually used to be one of the main ingredients in Pepsi-Cola. Not any longer. Pipsissewa grows all around where I live in southern Oregon, in the mountains of southern Oregon, northern California. It grows in a world, grows about so tall. And most of the commercial harvesters take the whole plant. You have to bend down, you take the whole plant off, and they can wipe out almost a whole area. We don't do that. Depending upon the size of the plant, we'll take the top first or the second whorl of leaves, pluck them off, and leave the rest of the plant there. And we've been harvesting in some areas for 25 years, and there's more herb there now before we started harvesting. I call it wild horticulture. So we can have our herbs and eat them too. Here's another example of trillium or beth root, which actually means birth root. This herb is highly endangered in some areas. The property on my farm, we've left about it's an 85-acre farm. We've left about 20 acres of it wild. We do go in and clear. It's maintained wild, if you will. We were lucky enough to have about, when we first moved to this farm 15 years ago, we had about 30 or 40 of these beth roots growing there, and I was so blessed to have them. They're such a beautiful plant. And we never touched them. We just left them there. But what we did have been doing over the years is when they go to seed in the fall, we harvest those seeds. We go back and we keep planting those seeds. Now, can you call that agriculture? You know, some people call it woods grown. Is a commercial term that's used, but we plant those seeds now, and about 15 years later, we have several hundred of these beth roots growing there. We're still not harvesting them. Someday, maybe. I don't know. We may harvest a few, but at this point, we're just happy to keep proliferating them. It's another herb that's very famous worldwide, St. John's wort, or Hypericum perforatum. In fact, you can see the perforated leaves. You see where it gets the name perforatum. Those little perforations in the leaves, which are oil glands. And where I live in southern Oregon, northern California, is the second largest growth of St. John's wort in the world. Cultivating St. John's wort in the area I live in is like Coles to Newcastle. Why should you cultivate what is just so plentiful and so bountiful? And we do a lot of harvesting. This is an herb that I sell a tremendous amount. We have one family, a fellow and his wife, his three children, who've been harvesting for us now for 5 years. And on average, every summer, that family makes about $15,000 to $20,000 just harvesting this one herb. It's half of their income, which they do in about 2 months. We started harvesting around St. John's Day, June 23rd, a very auspicious occasion for St. John's wort. Fortunately, we can follow it up the mountain. In the valley, when it starts to go to seed and we no longer think it's optimal to harvest, we go up a few hundred feet, and there it is, starting to bloom. So we literally can harvest it up to about several thousand feet. Because we, even though it's a very homogeneous population of St. John's Wort, we do find some variation in the chemical profile. And so what we do at the end of the year, we will make about somewhere on the average of about 10 or 15 different batches of St. John's Wort. And at the end of the year, we blend them all together. So let's blend it all as one. And so what you see here in this chromatograph, this HP high performance thin layer chromatograph, this is six years of samples from 6 different years. Look at the uniformity. It's very, very, very uniform, even though the individual batches may vary a little bit. And I was actually shocked when we did this particular research at the consistency of the chemical profile. I'm going to talk now about cultivated herbs. This photograph here is, since our inception 30 years ago, we do what we call a work study herbiculture intern program, something we're very, very proud of. And it, we do 3 different sessions that last about 9 weeks each, so about 6 months out of the year. We have, sometimes I call it voluntary slave labor. We don't pay them anything. They don't pay us anything. We work them very hard, but we also offer classes, field trips, really hands-on experience. And some of my best interns over the years have become employees. My farm manager is an ex-intern who was an exemplary student and hard worker. We hired him to work on the farm, and over a period of years, he's now our farm manager. And so we're going to talk about the farm here and cultivating. We, like I said, we have 85 acres of on the farm. 35 acres is under cultivation. We'd like to grow more, but basically we have 35 acres worth of water. We had more water, we'd grow more herbs. Here, by the way, is Matricaria chamomilla, or chamomile, or in the United States sometimes called German chamomile. By the way, did I mention we're certified organic? We were one of the first certified organic herb farms in the United States. I find it somewhat ironic and interesting that a lot of herbs that are cultivated worldwide are cultivated with pesticides and chemical poisons. What an irony to grow medicine with poisons, not to mention dumping millions and millions of gallons of poisons on the planet Earth every year. It's just a contradiction that boggles my mind. We also have what we call our botanical education garden, which is a more formal botanical garden, which we use for, I call it my herbal church. This is where I commune specifically with God, my own personal way. We also use this as a for small test plots. When we first start with experimenting with growing new crops, we'll start in this particular garden, and it also serves as an education area for our interns. This pergola you're seeing here, by the way, we also do classes, and so far we've had 4 couples that work at Herb Farm get married in this pergola. By the way, what you're seeing in that round is those are 4 different times that are growing in this circle here. It's just another shot of the botanical education garden. So let's talk about initially plants that we're growing that we've taken out of the wild and are figuring out how to cultivate. This is somewhat of a controversial subject. Can you make a lot of mistakes? Of course you can. You can make mistakes in anything you should start to do in life, especially if you do it for the first time. We are a founding member and a very supportive and a corporate sponsor of an organization in the United States called United Plant Savers. It was started about 15 years ago by a very, very dear friend of mine, Rosemary Gladstar. The purpose of of United Plant Savers is basically to more than anything, raise consciousness in the United States about the endangered and at-risk wild medicinal herbs and what can we do about it in terms of conservation, in terms of where you buy or where you don't buy, cultivation, things of that sort. And my farm is a United Plant Savers Botanical Sanctuary, which means that we research and cultivate endangered and at-risk medicinal herbs, and we also do public education. So we're open to, quite often open to tours. We also do symposia and good old-fashioned Southern California, Northern California, Southern Oregon Herb Fest. This is a list of the United Plant Savers. We have two different lists. We call the at-risk list. Some of these in this, and I'm going to talk about them further in the slideshow, some of these are endangered species. In other words, they have a legal definition of being endangered. It's against the law to pick them, to buy and sell them. But not all of them at all. We also have the UPS to watch list. These are herbs that we're concerned about. There's a lot still in the wild, but we're worried about them. We're worried about what's going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So I'm going to go in and fairly quickly go and talk about some of these herbs that we've worked with. Venus flytrap is an endangered species. It's highly illegal to harvest them. In fact, you have to have a special permit from the United States Department of Agriculture to even cultivate them or to buy and sell them. This is an herb, by the way, that we don't grow on our farm because we don't have the habitat for it. It grows in marshes. It's being wiped out more than anything, not from over-harvesting, but actually from encroachment of habitat and drying up of wetlands. This is a highly endangered species. You see poor Jiminy Cricket here as lunch, and will soon be digested as soon as the plant closes on top of him. Golden seal, or Hydrastis canadensis, is not very well known worldwide, except the United States. It's extremely popular, and of course in England and Australia and New Zealand, because they use a lot of American herbs. Golden seal is a superstar seller. There's less and less of it in the wild. About 20 years ago, it was $8 a pound. Now it's $80 a pound. We have spent basically 12 years figuring out how to cultivate it. It's interesting, I have a friend and a competitor call me once. He says, I hear you're growing golden seal. I said, yes. He says, you are. And is it pretty easy to grow? I said, it's really easy if you know how. It only took us 15 years to figure out how easy it is. Echinacea, our superstar. We grow a lot of echinacea, and it only took us about 10 years to master growing echinacea. Of course, what we're trying to do with these herbs as much as possible is to, if need be, recreate as close as possible their natural environment. Southern Oregon, where I live, is extremely hot and dry, and yet we have a killing frost. And echinacea thrives where we're at. It does now that we figured out a few things. Echinacea likes a very sweet soil. In its natural habitat, it'll sometimes grow almost in pure limestone. And so we take a lot of lime and sweeten our soil because our soil naturally tends to be a little acidic. And we found when we did that, we got a much higher yield. The constituent levels, the alkalamides and some of the other immunopotentiating compounds reached a much higher level. And we do comparative analysis of the wild herbs biochemically with what we cultivate, trying to, as much as possible, to recreate the same chemical profile. Here we're planting golden echinacea starts, harvesting. We use the root, the leaf, the flower, and the seed. We were the first company, and to my knowledge, in the world, the history of the world, to ever use the seed. The seeds are extremely high in alkalamides, immunopotentiating compounds, antiviral compounds that are in the seed. Here we're using the leaf and flower. We strip the stems off and compost the stems. Here's a vertical cut mixer. It's the same kind of blender that you have in your kitchen, except mine costs $20,000 and has a 16-horsepower motor. We blend that in with a set formula of distilled water, and we use certified organic ethanol. Pharmaceutical grade certified organic ethanol. Of course, American ginseng, I'm sure you're all very familiar with ginseng here. American ginseng, the Chinese relish it, they love it. When I go to buy Chinese herbs in Hong Kong or Singapore, I always bring some nice American ginseng roots. And I always give them to usually the grandfather. And especially if I can get, I don't do it anymore, but I used to bring the nice wild ginsengs. They always appreciate it, and then, of course, they owe me. Black cohosh, or Simus effuga racemosa, has always been a very popular herb, but has become a superstar in the last 5 years or so. And, of course, the problem with that is that the wild harvesting just went up tenfold. There were literally tons and tons being harvested every month. How much time do I have?
Minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. My time does slide. I really have to go speed ahead here. I'm only about a third of the way through here. Dioscorea villosa is one that we grow. Bloodroot. False unicorn. Blue cause. Some of these you're probably not familiar with. Meadowsweet. Actually, one of the biggest myths is that aspirin was discovered in willow bark. No, it was discovered in meadowsweet. In fact, the original botanical name Spirea is where the name aspirin came from. We're harvesting here. Celandine, andrographis, very popular herb in traditional Chinese medicine and also in Thailand. Just was designated as a drug in Thailand. We found that the andrographis we were getting from China was terrible quality, just terrible quality. So we were forced to grow it ourselves if we wanted something that we felt good about. We also grow astragalus in very poor soil, by the way. We grew it in really rich soil. It grew really nice, big plants that looked beautiful. When we analyzed the roots, they looked terrible. We realized, after conferring with some friends in China, that it actually did better in poor soil. Blue flag, California poppy. I'm sorry for going so fast. Time slipped by me. Spilanthes is something that's a tropical plant, but we have very good success with it because we have very, very hot summers in southern Oregon. This is an herb that is on the endangered list. This is an herb that we bought back, Cactus granulophorus, Ciliaceros granulophorus, one of the most beautiful flowers I've ever seen. Only blooms at night, blooms for about 3 hours and then rots. It's a great cardiovascular tonic. Ashwagandha. Again, we got so many different samples from India. They all were terrible. Just terrible. The quality was overdried, very, very bad chemical profile. So we were again forced to grow it ourselves. Rhodiola, we're working with some people in northern Canada around the Arctic Circle who will hopefully have next year their first harvest of certified organic rhodiola. This is an herb that is being wiped out in its natural habitat, and we refuse to buy the cultivated. I mean, Kaba Kaba. Great. I buy my in Vanuatu. By the way, I'm the tall white guy here. This is the king's, the chief's private patch here. Notice the wristwatch. And after I took his photograph, this is, by the way, it's a 3-day walk from one of the most isolated islands. After I took his photograph, he went in his hut and came out and took photographs of me, even though it was a 6-day walk to get the film developed. There are actually now 23 known kaba lactones, but there are many chemotypes. There can be different ratios of kaba lactones, so you can see 10 different products that say 30% kaba lactones. My first question is, what's the other 70%? Which they usually kind of puzzle them. What do you mean? What's the other 70%? And then I say, what's the kaba lactone profile? If you have what they call 2-day kaba, which one German company is growing huge acres of it in Vanuatu because it grows faster. Nobody, after cultivating this for 4,000 years in the South Pacific, nobody drinks 2-day kava. But yet most of the standardized extract coming out of Europe are the kava that nobody in its natural habitat that people have been drinking for 4,000 years, they won't drink it. So there's an irony for you. Oh, I'm sorry, by the way, that's just looking at the chemical profile of a Maca, Lepidium myenia, this is a fun herb. It has been cultivated for about 3,000 years in the highlands of Peru. I get it at about 16,000 feet above sea level, where it really thrives. The plant almost died out, and yet there's been a sort of a maca renaissance. It has a folk tradition of being used as a fertility agent in both men and women, and fortunately modern science is proving that indeed that is a fact. It is not just a hearsay or an old wives' tale. This is actually at a kaba fair. Maca. Maca, this is at 16,000 feet in an altiplano. Nothing grows above 4 inches here because of the winds. You ask what's the weather like there. The weather, they have all four seasons in the same hour. And this is a fascinating herb. These are maca farmers. This is a grandmother, mother and daughter, harvesting maca. This gentleman is a Quechua Indian who's college educated. These farmers have gotten screwed for years from unethical buyers that come in, because a lot of these farmers, most of them can't read or write. They can't do math. They are easily bullied. This is who I do business with. He has created a co-op. He's also created the Maca Growers Association of Peru. We told him that we are very happy to pay significantly above, 20 to 40% above the market price, to get what we want and to create that kind of relationship. This is also why we do this. How is he going to make a living 30 years from now? By creating a market for this product and paying a fair price, hopefully he will also be a maca farmer. Okay, now we're still in Peru. We're going down the western slopes into the Ucayali River. Zero. Okay. Well, I got 10 minutes of questions, right? Can I use 5 of that for the rest of the slides? Thank you. Okay, this is on the Ucayali River in the Peruvian Amazon. And we're going looking for a herb called cat's claw, Uncaria tomentosa. This is an herb that's become very, very popular, extremely popular. A Latin American, I don't know the guy, but a very famous poet, singer in Mexico, claims to have been cured of cancer. And has been interviewed all over Latin America, and this herb went from sort of slightly unknown to like a superstar, especially all over Latin America. And of course, it came to the United States because there are so many immigrants coming in from Latin America to the United States. So again, with its extreme popularity, it's being wiped out. The reason that we went here, it's a lana, by the way, a vine, the Tarzan vine, that grows way, way up, and this gentleman climbs up about 60-some feet up into the air and cuts the top of it off. It also has delicious water. You can get lots of water. If you get thirsty, you just drink it straight there. We strip the bark off. Here it's drying. But the reason that we're working with these people, we're working with some people, agronomists at the University of Peru School of Agriculture, is we're going in, he's going in, and we're supporting this, and teaching them how to propagate these plants. They're still harvesting from the wild, but now they're, for the last 5 years, they've been planting into the wild with their small nurseries. And again, why are they doing this? Why do we want to support this? Well, besides getting really good quality and getting a great marketing story out of it, again, this is why we're also doing it. How are these kids going to make a living when they're adults? This is dragon's blood. It's a lot of herbs called dragon's blood. It's a resin that oozes out of this croton. I forget the species name, but it's a genus is croton. And this is an herb that, it's actually just a pure resin is tapped, it's filtered, and it preserves itself. It's a great antiviral, and also stimulates regeneration of healthy new tissue. And that's it. Thank you. Any questions?
2 minutes left.
Yes.
Yeah, my question is, you mentioned, several instances, but for example, this ashwagandha you got from India, and then you did the chemical profile and found out that it was bad quality. And I wondered, according to what standards, are there any established standards what makes ashwagandha good quality, or you're just looking for one active ingredient?
Well,
how do you measure that?
Well, we go through and look at the literature that's there, and basically try to see, can we find what the literature is talking about? Quite frankly, 80% of it, I knew I didn't want the minute I looked at it. You know, the minute I smelled it, the minute I tasted it, I knew I would never buy it because of just poor quality control. Fungus smell, color, things of that sort. You know, just organoleptically, I rejected 80% of it on sight. without ever taking it to the lab. Although we did take it to the lab to educate ourselves about what we would find.
But so you mean there are some standards for the lab tests according to which you measure?
I'm sorry, okay.
So there are some standards when you are finally do the lab
tests? There are standards that we've established.
Oh, you established?
Yeah. Through our own work. I mean, through looking at, you know, looking at the literature that's there. You know, I mean, we have to work with what we have. We don't have the funding to spend the $1 million that I would like to spend to give you that definitive answer that you're asking for. Okay, so we have to work with what we have, and we feel good about what, you know, we feel good about what we're doing, and we also get great feedback. 20% of our customers are doctors, mostly naturopathic doctors. Ultimately, again, these are not double-blind crossover studies, but our customers are very happy, and especially the practitioners say that they get good results with it. Yes?
This is really interesting work. It reminds me a lot of a company that came out, I don't know, 25, maybe 30 years ago called Shaman Pharmaceuticals. And so
Shaman's working with the dragon's blood. They've done a tremendous amount of research on dragon's blood. I have traveled in over 60 different countries. I've been, you know, I get it from everything from Hippocrates' writings 2,000 years ago to the latest research coming off the internet. I have a huge library. Quite frankly, I have as much faith, sometimes more faith, in talking to healers who are practicing traditions that's thousands of years old. And talking to multiple, you know, and telling me things, and also especially multicultural, I have as much faith in that as I do science. I mean, if you read the scientific literature over the last 30 years, you realize that science is not always right. The so-called active compound in valerian has changed 4 times in the last 30 years. Now they have one of the researchers in Germany has a radical new theory that's all the chemical compounds working in synergy. Wow. What genius. Yes?
Do you have any particular season for the collection of the different parts of the month? If not, why? If yes, why?
Well, very, very much so, obviously. I mean, we aren't going to pick St. John's wort flowers in when there's it's the middle of the winter. No, we very much, in some plants, we even the time of day can be very important. Some plants we like to get while the dew is still on them, like with our chamomile, we like to get it fairly early in the morning before the sun heats them up and we start losing some of those higher note essential oils. So we spend definitely in terms of time of year, time of day, can be very critical, and we follow very strict guidelines on that. Some herbs will give you a very small window of opportunity. Some herbs will give you a very large window. Large window of opportunity.
Yes, I have one more question. First of all, I would like to say the presentation is very interesting, very impressive to me. I'm working on the same work, but I'm from a research institute, not a pharma company. Your topic of the presentation is sustainable harvesting, not so sustainable harvesting wild medicine plants, right? As I can see, you have presented a lot of medicinal plants which are in cultivation.
Yes.
And mostly the annual crops or perennial herbal plants. But for the wood plants, for the trees, for the perennial herbal plants, in the wild situation, how do you work with the local people to do the sustainable harvesting of the wild resources?
Well, education.
Education.
Yeah, I mean, I have the fun job of traveling all over the world and spending a lot of time with it. A lot of times, they teach me.
What kind of education?
I have a high school diploma and 2 years of college.
And
30 years of...
community people how to harvest.
Yes. Well, like I said, sometimes I don't have to teach them anything.
Okay.
Sometimes I have to hold their hand.
But different medicinal plants has different way to... harvesting, to reach the harvest, sustainable harvesting, how can you reach that if you don't have the research background, if you don't have the experimentation work beforehand?
I read herb books that go back hundreds of years. It doesn't have to be written by a PhD to be valid information. Okay. When I go to these the people and these Indians to harvest.
The Piranha Columbia woody plant. That's the name you call it, Ancasseria tomentosa. That's a Columbian woody plant, right?
You cut. It's a lana.
Yes. You can't understand and to show.
They leave about that much above the ground so we don't kill the plant.
Once you harvest the stem of the climbing plant, then how can you regenerate the next?
Like I said, we leave that much of the, at least that much of the plant and its root in the ground. So we haven't killed the plant, we just cut the top off. Okay, there are many herbs that you can cut the top off, you don't kill the plant. Also, I also explained that we're working with these people because they are cultivating, they are propagating. They're concerned about the future. They understand, you know, that this plant is being wiped out, and they want to propagate, and they are propagating, and they have been propagating for 5 years.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we need to stay on time. Okay. I'm sure